United States versus Gregory Kern.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Counsel. Rosanne DeYoung appears by Attorney Victor Plantinga. Your Honor, Rosanne DeYoung is a law firm that is an intervener in this appeal.
Did you formally intervene in the proceedings at some point?
Well, the procedural history of this is rather unusual.
Just tell me where in the record we'll find yes or no.
Okay. I suppose you could argue that when we wrote the court, following 2 months after the judge issued some order that affected us, we at that point intervened. We also filed a brief in the court requesting an evidentiary hearing and explaining the nature of our interest.
Do you view yourself as having formally intervened?
I suppose we have, yes.
Okay.
If I could go just a very short background on the facts. Rosanne DeYoung did not represent Mr. Kern, who is the defendant in this criminal action. We did not defend him in the criminal action. In 1999, we represented Mr. Kern in a civil lawsuit that he had as a part of a corporation in which he was an officer. We represented him from 1999 for several years in this civil lawsuit, and we were, during almost till the very end, we were unaware that he had any criminal problems, that he had been prosecuted in federal court for bank fraud. And it's very important, I think, that none of the proceeds at issue because of this civil lawsuit are in any way tainted as the result of any criminal activity that Mr. Kern engaged in.
If this fund had consisted entirely of Mr. Kern's money, if he paid your fees all along and was now entitled to the entire judgment, okay, what process should the United States or the district court have followed in collecting this judgment that you held in trust?
First of all, if Mr. Kern had paid the legal fees as the civil action was proceeding, the government would have no claim to that at all. In the same way that Mr. Kern may have made mortgage payments on his residence, the bank wouldn't have to return those funds. If he bought groceries at the local store, the bank or the grocery store wouldn't have to return those monies. There's a process through the statute that if they are tainted funds, there's a process that the government can go through and make a claim to those. That process simply is inapplicable here when there is no connection between this civil lawsuit and any bank fraud or any money owing that Mr. Kern owes as restitution to the victims of that bank fraud.
You didn't know when you were representing him that he had been or was being exposed to criminal prosecution for something in connection with his activity?
His first conviction was in 1996 for bank fraud. We represented him in 1999. During the whole time frame that we represented him, he was making payments on that 1996 restitution that he owed from that 96 conviction. We didn't know that, actually. He never told us about this. We actually learned of his criminal problems when we were at mediation, and some of the people he had been associated with in this corporation said, "I don't know how you're going to prove your case. He's probably going to federal prison any time now." We didn't know that.
That's the first time you knew he had criminal problems.
Right. We didn't know he had criminal problems.
Did you real quick go into Nexus?
I think we asked our client, and it was at that time that he thought that might be information we'd want to know because we're facing a trial date with a person who could be in a federal penitentiary just about anywhere in the country, and we'd be unlikely to be able to produce him. Obviously, it would have been nice if we had known that, but I don't know that would be determinative in any event. What we have here is that in November of 2001, the court, Judge Randa, issued an order forfeiting all of the proceeds of that lawsuit to apply to Mr. Kern's criminal restitution victims. We weren't given notice of that order. The government never even let us know about this. We finally learned in January of 2002, some 2 months after that, when someone wrote the court about this earlier order and copied us in on it. That was the first time we ever learned that what we claim are attorney fees and also monies that we paid out of pocket for expert witness fees were being forfeited in this unrelated case. The court relied on 31 U.S.C. 3713 for the basis for its action. And I'd like to focus my argument, if I could, on this, because I do believe that the analysis of this statute will be dispositive in this appeal. This is a government claim priority statute, and it consists of really two parts. There's sub A that gives the government priority, and then there's sub B that holds certain people individually responsible for paying out monies before satisfying a government claim. The purpose of the statute, and by the way, this statute goes back to 1797. I did not find any legislative history in which I can enlighten the court on, but this is a very old statute. Sub B was added in 1935. And basically the purpose of the statute as developed by case law is that it is to protect the public revenue. It does not apply by case law, by Supreme Court case law, in fact, that it does not apply when the beneficiaries are private persons. And this is what we have here, that people who are benefiting from this statute, if it were applied, are not government claims for taxes or whatever the government's claims are, but actually two private corporations, First Star and Cumis Insurance. This isn't a claim of the government. The government merely is acting as a conduit to take this restitution money and to take that money and then disperse it out to private persons. So I think the first objection to the court using this statute is that it simply is inapplicable to our case. These aren't private persons. There are private persons who are benefiting, and it's not a claim of the government.
Well, even if it's restitution, I guess this is perhaps the question, is whether that puts some sort of a government label on it, since the government, you know, it's a conviction, it's a crime against the government, and part of it is restitution to the victim. I know that's going to have to be characterized that way, and apparently there's no precedent one way or the other.
There really isn't.
This would be a case of first impression, whichever way it goes.
It would be in that respect. I think even if you do consider that 3713 is applicable.
Well, that's what you're using as the main focus of why it is, why it shouldn't go, and why it shouldn't be applied.
Yeah, I'm using this only because this was the court's basis for making its decision, and I think it's in error. But even if the overall statute would apply, which we do not concede that it does, the government still loses because the case law says that this statute doesn't give the government a super priority lien that somehow trumps all of the state lien law for which it's applied. The claim that we have to our fees and our costs has to do with a statutory lien in Wisconsin, 75736. We also have an equitable lien. Now, the government tries to distinguish and says, well, an equitable lien is a judicially created lien because it wants to protect against unjust enrichment. And because Mr. Kern didn't receive any of these proceeds, he hasn't benefited. But that misses the point. Mr. Kern has civil judgments against him from these two corporations. He owes criminal restitution by court order. The fact that his obligations are reduced because of the payment of those funds is similar to a situation where someone promises to pay your bank mortgage. One could not argue that because the money never comes into your hands that you somehow haven't been benefited. And such is the case with Mr. Kern. he's been benefited because money that he's obligated to pay civilly and criminally is now less because of the effort.
Are you claiming it's your first in time, too?
We do. We had
on the grounds of this, whatever he signed in October?
We have a written document that he signed that statutorily gives us priority. It was prior in time to the court issuing the order. Secondly,
he signed the document in what, October, and the order was entered in November.
Yes. Additionally,
what exactly did he do in October?
In October?
Yeah.
There's a document that he signed.
I don't think the document is not in the record of this case.
Right, and that's part of the problem, Your Honor. We asked for an evidentiary hearing so that we could present the priority of our claim, and the court denied us.
Why do you need an evidentiary hearing for that? Why can't you just file something?
Well, part of it was we did assert in the only thing that can be constituted a pleading, we did argue that we had a prior lien by statute that predated the court's November 2001 decision. Additionally, the case law establishes that the equitable lien goes back to the time of representation, which would have been in 1999 when we first started representing Mr. Kern. If I could...
Under the Wisconsin law, when does the lien attach?
Equitable lien at the time representation begins.
Statutory lien.
Statutory lien anytime there's a written document that evidences giving the attorney a lien in writing under the statute. If I could...
And that was when?
October of 2001.
And where was it filed?
It doesn't have to be filed in Wisconsin. There's no requirement of
constructive notice?
There's no provision for filing it with the Register of Deeds or putting anyone on notice. If I could, because I think it's important, the government says that all of the cases deal with sub A that I've cited and not sub B. Sub B is the personal liability. You cannot consider sub A separate from sub B. And let me give you an example of why this is the case. If I'm an attorney, if taking the government's argument, if I'm an attorney who represents someone in a personal injury case, and I settle it, and I pay out the subrogated health insurer, and let's say that I don't know that my client owes federal taxes or some other government obligation. If you take the government's argument on sub B that it stands alone, is considered alone, then I as an attorney am personally liable for any amount I paid to the subrogated health insurer. Obviously that makes no sense. What has to happen, and which has been in the case law wherever sub B has been considered, is that it is read in conjunction with sub A. It wasn't accidental that these provisions were put in there in the very same statute. The other key point is when the Supreme Court, in the New Berlin case that I cited, talked about this statute not creating a, quote, super lien on behalf of the government, that decision where it says it will never act in that manner was after sub B was created. Sub B was already on the books when the Supreme Court in New Berlin said, don't think of this statute as a super lien for the government that trumps all state law liens. It isn't. It doesn't work that way. And certainly, were the New Berlin court to have made an exception for sub B, which logically makes no sense, one would think that that would be the case. The government cannot cite a single case where sub B somehow gives the government a super priority over state law liens, and frankly, there would be real problems with federalism if that were the case. That I'd like to save what remaining time I have for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Mel Johnson. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the United States in this case. Before I begin the argument that I had planned for today, I wanted to address a couple of things that were stated by Mr. Plantinga. First of all, I think perhaps it may be more in the nature of a slip of the tongue as opposed to any real argument, but Mr. Plantinga several times referred to this as a forfeiture, and in his written arguments he's also referred to this as a forfeiture. I want to emphasize that this is not a forfeiture. There are different legal standards for forfeitures under the federal statutes, and there are also problems with even using a forfeiture to obtain money for restitution. Therefore, I want to make it clear that this was not a forfeiture decision by Judge Randa. I also would like to dispute something that Mr. Plantinga said about the priority in time. He has stated that the attorney's lien that Rosen DeYoung had priority in time over Judge Randa's decisions regarding the $50,000. It's not accurate to say, though, that the firm's claim has any priority in time over the criminal victims. With regard to Cumis Insurance, which was the victim in the earlier bank fraud case, there was a judgment in favor of Cumis Insurance, which was filed May 22, 1996, several years, more than 5 years before the firm's lien. So that Cumis clearly had priority in time over the firm. And with regard to the other victim, First Star Bank, while the criminal judgment was not issued until early 2002, the criminal acts which gave rise to Mr. Kern's second bank fraud conviction occurred in 1996, again years before the firm's interests arose.
Would you concede that the law firm is entitled to some of the proceeds of the lawsuit, like the out-of-pocket expenses to the expert witness?
Not necessarily. It's been our position throughout that the law firm is no more than a creditor of Mr. Kern's, just like other creditors, including the criminal victims, and that they're not entitled to priority for their fees and costs. Now, the firm has argued that Judge Randa lacked personal jurisdiction over the firm, but there are a couple of fatal flaws with that argument. First of all, the firm failed to preserve any issue of personal jurisdiction. The firm claims it was never made a party to this case.
You're arguing waiver, right?
Yes. Well, I guess technically forfeiture rather than waiver. But in any event, the issue hasn't been preserved such that the firm can rely on it on this appeal. The firm claims it was never made a party, but as was noted in your original question, Judge Rovner, in effect, the firm made itself a party by interjecting itself into the matter which was then pending before Judge Randa. After the judge ordered the defendant to turn over the $50,000 for restitution, the law firm interjected itself and asked to get $21,000 of that money. It did not assert any lack of jurisdiction at that time because it wanted something from the court. Only later did Rosen DeYoung state in one of its three submissions that the court had no jurisdiction over the firm. But the firm never really argued that point then or in later submissions. It just stated it on that one occasion. So the most that the firm did was once mention the issue, but then never pursue it. And it's not acceptable for a party to seek a resolution of the merits of litigation without obtaining any decision on a purported jurisdictional issue, and then appeal on that jurisdictional issue if the outcome on the merits was not favorable to that party.
And something is so terribly wrong procedurally here. The district court enters an order against a non-party.
Well, I would dispute that.
I still don't know if they formally intervened or if they are simply calling themselves interveners for lack of a better designation. There's no judgment against Rosen DeYoung, yet the court's order of August 22nd requires the firm to pay the U.S. attorney the sum of $50,000. The order specifies that the money is from the settlement awarded to Kern, but the court doesn't acknowledge that at least some of the money had already been disbursed to the law firm and the expert witness. Seems to me the first major problem is that the district court never addressed the jurisdictional objection that Rosen DeJong raised.
Well, it is true that that issue was not specifically addressed by Judge Randa. I guess it was implicitly addressed because he went ahead and ruled.
But it's unclear to me why a court feels it can order a non-party to pay money without any kind of notice or hearing.
Well, I think that that's not exactly an accurate characterization of what occurred. The court did not order the firm to do anything. The court ordered that $50,000 of Mr. Kern's money awarded to Mr. Kern in the settlement of the Hockey Haven litigation be turned over for restitution to the victims in his two criminal cases. The argument that the firm has made that Judge Randa lacked jurisdiction over the firm, I think, misconstrues the situation in that way. Fundamentally, the district court was not ordering the law firm to pay anything for the benefit of the defendant. The court was ordering that the defendant's money that the defendant obtained through the Hockey Haven litigation be turned over for restitution. And from that perspective, personal jurisdiction over the firm was largely beside the point. Rosen DeJong was not dragged into the case, but inserted itself because it wanted something. And it inserted itself by arguing that it had priority to $21,000, which it later raised to $26,000, of the defendant's money. It asserted it had priority.
What should it have done? I mean, here's a law firm that has a fee agreement. It's already taken its cut from the settlement before it ever learned that the court had issued a restitution order freezing the settlement fund. They'd worked on it for 2 years before the court entered its order. Well, I mean, and they have an equitable interest, it seems to me. There wouldn't be a fund if the firm hadn't pursued the litigation. What a mess this is.
Well, I wouldn't deny that. However, the fact that it's a complicated and unusual situation, and the fact that, as I would concede, that the law firm has an interest in collecting its fees and costs, doesn't really answer the question here. And the question is, can the law firm assert that it has priority over other creditors of the defendant, other creditors who are creditors as a result of the defendant's criminal conviction?
I'd like to ask a question in that regard. It really relates back to your point you made a few minutes ago about who was first in time here to this money. Now, the order of Judge Randa, which is on appeal here, the first aspect of it, wasn't entered until when? December of 2001.
Well, there were actually a series of orders. There were a series of orders.
Well, that was the first one directed at this particular fund, was it not?
I think it was
November
of 2001. It was November 2nd, 2001.
November, all right. But that's the first time that there was any order directed to the $50,000 that we're concerned with in this case.
That's correct.
And you said, well, the restitution as a general proposition was ordered back in, 1996.
That's correct.
As I say, that is not I'm not sure that's relevant because it isn't directed toward this particular funds that are in contest here. First judicial order directed at those funds was this November order of Judge Randa. What's your view of that? I mean, they can pick various points at which their liens supposedly attached, but shouldn't we count your claim from the time that Judge Randa decided the priorities as it affected the $50,000?
Well, I think to the extent that the timing of the claims is relevant here, any time when you're assessing the relative claims of different creditors and you want to know who has priority in time, I think you go to the date that the claim arose as opposed to the date that they made a specific claim at the specific property that they learned about years later. And therefore, for example, if there are a series of liens filed against a certain person with regard to real property. And years later, it comes up that that person owned some real property that maybe none of the creditors were specifically aware of or knowledgeable about. Then you go back to the date on which their respective liens were filed, and it doesn't depend
but
on
the... But the restitution order does not impose a lien on anything, does it?
Well, no, but a lien was filed by the United States, as is uniformly done in matters of criminal judgments imposing fines of restitution.
When was your lien filed?
Would have been soon after May 22nd, 1996.
Don't you think we ought to remand this so Judge Randa can resolve the jurisdictional issue, the factual issues about the ownership of the fund, and the legal issues about the ownership of the fund? I mean, there's something very odd. There has to be a procedure that the U.S. follows when it believes a third party is holding funds for a defendant, and it has to involve more than a letter to a court with a carbon copy to an innocent third party. There just has to be.
Well,
there doesn't have to be.
I wouldn't necessarily say this was the optimal procedure. On the other hand, I wouldn't say it's a reversible procedure either. In other words, while there was a somewhat balky beginning to the litigation of these issues, Rosen DeYoung had a full opportunity to make its arguments, either jurisdictional arguments if it cared to, or arguments on the merits. It made three separate written submissions to Judge Randa. He ruled, I think he issued a total of four different orders addressing various issues raised by Rosen DeYoung, and so it was fully and fairly litigated.
You say three. The letter is one. The motion for an evidentiary hearing is two. What's three?
There were three letters. One was... number 28 in the record, a letter dated February 22nd, 2002 to Judge Randa from the firm, then another letter to Judge Randa from the firm, which is record entry number 31, and then a later motion with memorandum, a motion for evidentiary hearing with supporting memorandum. So there was a full and fair opportunity for the firm to express its views on the merits of jurisdictional issues. It took that opportunity. Judge Randa never said you're too late or refused in any way to address the issues raised by Rosen DeYoung, and he issued his decision. There's really no basis to remand at this time, especially if we consider, as I argued earlier, that there really is no jurisdictional problem here because...
Tell me this. Have you ever heard, forgive me for interrupting, but have you ever heard of a requirement that money be paid to a party without a judgment?
There is a judgment. There's
a judgment against Rosen DeYoung?
No, there was a judgment against Mr. Kern.
And I know, but
this is not Rosen DeYoung's money. This is Gregory Kern's money.
This is in a trust account, isn't it?
Well, you think it's his money.
Yes, I believe it was held by in a trust account.
In a trust account. I'm not sure what the distinction is between, you know, a trust account is the client's money generally. It's
yes.
The law firm. It's not the firm. If this had been in a bank account, and the order is to attach the bank account for the same reason here, do you make the bank a party, or do you just put it out of notice and they freeze it?
Well, I believe that in that case, at least a possible procedure would be to garnish the bank account.
And was there any garnishment here pursuant to the criminal sentence?
There was not.
When you said you filed a lien, what does that mean? Is it filed against any particular piece of property?
No. And that lien is generally... I didn't bring that up to say that we had a lien against this money.
What's the lien good for?
Well, I think the liens we commonly file are aimed at real property more than property like this.
Mr. Johnson, if the defendant had paid the firm on a monthly basis for the work they performed,
in the lawsuit, would the court be able to order a disgorgement of the fees paid?
Well, in that event, well, are you saying that these payments were somehow subtracted from the $50,000?
Yeah, well, they were paying them, you know, on a monthly basis.
I'd be lying if I told you I had a clear answer to that, but that's not the case we have here today.
I just like to follow up on this lien. You said that the United States filed a lien pursuant to the restitution order back in 96. Now, what, against whom, and what does a lien require anybody to do?
Well, we commonly file liens against real property in any county in which we think the defendant lives or has any real property. You had earlier asked me, was any type of a lien filed, and I mentioned that one was filed. I don't contend that the lien that would have been filed on the basis of the 96 PR20 case applied to the $50,000. And I've not argued that we're entitled to that money as a result of the filing of any lien.
Okay.
See, my time is up unless you have other questions. I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Pettingus, how much time do you have? You got 1 minute.
I'll speak fast. The government seems to claim that, as it must, that we had some sort of procedural due process occurring because we did, in fact, address the court on 3 separate occasions regarding the personal jurisdiction issue. Yet I thought the government began arguing that we waived it. We weren't given much of an opportunity to address the court other than by letters to correct misstatements made by different parties. I'd also like to talk a little bit about liens. Liens are there for a purpose, whether it's a mechanics lien or a construction lien. It is meant to ensure that someone who improves property gets paid, and it gives them a priority by statute or otherwise so that people will undertake things that improve personal property. This is not quite like that. In this case, we didn't improve anything. We created a pool of money. A pool of money that has already benefited Mr. Kern's creditors. So I think that there's social reasons why this court should remand this. The court asked, may I finish this thought, sir? Okay. The court was asking questions about priority, factual questions that bore on this case, and that the questions the court asked were very relevant. They should have been addressed at the trial court, but we were denied an opportunity to present those facts to the trial court. Even though we requested. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Case will be taken under advisement.